Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone that we are now in our spring pledge drive, and you can donate today at kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321. Our goal for this pledge drive is $60,000, so help us get there by becoming a member today. On his first day in office, Joe Biden canceled the Keystone XL pipeline. That was great news, but that's not the only fossil fuel pipeline that needs to be stopped. Here in Oregon, people are still trying to stop for good the nearly dead Pacific Connector gas pipeline, while in the Midwest, people have been organizing since 2014 to halt Line 3, a proposed pipeline expansion to bring nearly 1 million barrels of tar sands per day from Alberta, Canada to Superior, Wisconsin. Today, we are joined by Elijah Cetus with the Braided River Campaign, who recently visited the proposed pipeline site. We'll talk about why he chose to go and connect with the water protectors in Wisconsin and the links between the struggle to stop Line 3 and the fossil fuel fights here in the Northwest. Elijah, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hey, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to start by talking about what Line 3 is. I think people are becoming a little bit more aware of it, but basically, when people think about pipelines, they think about the Keystone XL and don't realize that there's all these other pipelines that are also major problems. So let's talk about what Line 3 is and why you decided to go check it out.
Line 3 is a pipeline that runs from Alberta and connects Alberta, the tar sands extraction sites there, with refineries in Superior, Wisconsin. The pipeline is already in existence. It's one of the reasons that Enbridge has been, you know, claiming that they're building this massive pipeline expansion, is that the old pipeline is gotten to a point of disrepair, and they're citing all these environmental risks of that. But what we know about this Line 3 expansion is that it would bring enormous amounts of tar sands, and it would be an expansion akin to the Keystone XL, where, you know, by their estimates, it would bring 700,000 barrels of tar sands crude per day. But research by activists has shown that it's likely going to be more like close to 1 million barrels. And if we think about Keystone XL, you know, that was going to be an 800,000 barrel per day expansion of that system. And so Line 3 is really, it's a fight as big, as important as the Keystone XL fight. And then, of course, the most important issue with Line 3 is that it's crossing Anishinaabeg treaty territory, and a number of tribes in Minnesota have opposed the pipeline. And so first and foremost, it's an issue of sovereignty. It's an issue of water. It's an issue of the land. And then we know that it's an issue of our climate, where we cannot be building the infrastructure that allows for continued extraction of the tar sands. The other thing I'll say is that we know that this pipeline is a lifeline to the tar sands industry. The tar sands industry without these pipelines can't continue to produce at the rate that they've been producing. And the reason for this is that, you know, when they overproduce at the site, they cannot get enough of that material into the pipelines under their existing capacity. And so it reduces the price of the barrels, and it makes it basically financially unfeasible. But if the Line 3 expansion is completed, you know, estimates are that it could increase production of the tar sands by 10%, which is an enormous amount, and it can't happen.
This project sounds like it has some deja vu to what's been going on across British Columbia for the last few years with the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which is another example of a pipeline that already existed that Kinder Morgan had put through many years ago. And it was going to be twinned with the pipeline that's still being fought by tribes across British Columbia. And again, a case of it going through a lot of indigenous sovereign land. The other thing that is deja vu is Enbridge, who was going to put another pipeline across northern British Columbia, the Northern Gateway Pipeline, which was stopped. So I want to talk a little bit about the tension here with oil companies and pipeline companies trying to put these pipelines through indigenous lands.
You know, we live on stolen land across this country. We stand on stolen land, and so it's always going to be indigenous land. You know, each of the states that these pipelines cross, they cross indigenous territory, whether that's existing reservation lands or whether that's treaty lands that were then taken, or whether that's land that had been in allotment and was, you know, broken up from the existing reservation with the Dawes Act. I think it's really important to just ground that and say that, you know, that is the context of the West, right? And so any project that requires this much crossing and natural resource, you know, destruction is going to happen in indigenous territory. You know, as a just kind of a premise, like, this is ongoing colonialism, right? This is the continued theft of land. But I think too, like, at a certain point, what really matters with these pipelines is the, you know, the politics on the ground, and it's the local communities. And, you know, these companies will continually make sort of calculations about where they can put their pipelines based on all kinds of ideas about what the local population will do or say or resist. And, you know, we know that these calculations are callous and rooted in racism. That was the premise of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Is, you know, they routed it outside a major town that was a settler town, and they tried to bring it through, or did bring it through the Standing Rock Reservation, because of a calculation about essentially whose lives are worth more, whose water is worth more. So we see that kind of callous calculation all the time. Recently, too, the Byhalia pipeline, which is being, you know, it's an expansion that's being proposed, a connection in just south of Memphis, Tennessee. And that company, you know, basically in their report, when they were outlining the project, they said it would be the path of least resistance to go through a community called Boxtown, you know, which was a freedman's town. So it's primarily African-American families, descendants of slaves. And the community has put up a huge resistance. Just as in line three, the indigenous nations, the Anishinaabe, Ojibwe nations, have put up a huge resistance. I think what's really important with the line three to realize too is that the pipeline companies in Canada know that Canadians don't want a pipeline through their land either. There was actually a proposed pipeline, like you said, the Northern Gateway, and then also there was a proposal for a pipeline called Energy East, which would go from Alberta, you know, through southern Canada all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. And that faced enormous resistance and was eventually defeated. Likewise with Trans Mountain, you know, eventually the Kinder Morgan walked away from the project, and the government of Canada purchased the pipeline to force it through. And that's just how much, you know, people do not want to see more of this infrastructure built near them.
All right, let's get back for a second to the fact that the Canadian federal government bought the pipeline. Because on the one hand, people don't want it, but somebody who has a lot of clout does want it. And this is the great liberal Justin Trudeau who did this. So what does that say that Trudeau's government was so much in support and so much maybe in need of that pipeline going through?
Well, I think simply because Canada is a petro state. And like other petro states, they have an enormous dependence on oil and gas production. And there are extremely vested interests who do not want to see that economy change. And I think we have to understand Line 3 as essentially a power play by a Canadian company that's operating in a full-blown petro state. And they are trying their hardest to prop up their industry, the tar sands. You know, so just as a little background, I lived in Squamish Nation territory just north of so-called Vancouver, BC, which is unceded territory, so there was never a treaty for that land. It's you know, stolen land in a very, very direct sense and in a very legal sense. Living there as an American gave me such a window into the fact of ongoing colonialism and especially extractive economies and the way that that relates to settler colonialism in the West. We saw all those same things occur in the United States, obviously, and in Canada, it's so apparent in part because it is so directly stolen land in BC, right? Because it's never been ceded. And so that was an eye-opening experience for me living in so-called British Columbia, and seeing the powerful, powerful resistance from water protectors, the Squamish Nation, Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, you know, many of the Salish nations down in southern BC resisting this pipeline. You know, I think we really, as climate organizers, I think we have to, especially settler climate organizers, which I am, we have to really understand this as a process of land theft and as a process of really genocide. And I think the tar sands are, you know, the most important fight in the climate movement, in part because not only the enormous greenhouse gas emissions from the full life cycle of tar sands, which is, you know, it involves the clear cutting of boreal muskeg forests, which are, you know, one of the greatest carbon sinks on the planet and one of the last really old growth forests on this continent. But it also, you know, just the process of extracting the bitumen from the tar, it's basically a process of strip mining. You use enormous equipment, and then all of the refining that has to happen to create the tar sands. It's an insane proposal if you think about it, the tar sands, you know, in general, because you're using so much energy to produce an oil, you know, that we don't need at this point. Like, we do not need the tar sands. And one thing that's occurred, you know, a lot with this Line 3 is that Enbridge has leaned on this idea of, you know, the continued need for tar sands, the continued need for oil that we all use. And this is such an industry line, like, well, it's in the plastics you use, it's you drive to work. But the tar sands are just an insane proposal. That area is so, so remote from so much infrastructure. The amount of just capital and human energy that had to happen to create even the ability for that extraction, it just baffles the mind. And there's amazing histories of kind of how that happened that I wish I, you know, could repeat back right now. But it's well worth looking up some of those first pictures and just kind of looking through the way that this was created. Thinking about it that way, we know that it's a very, very artificial venture, you know, in the sense that it's a collusion between the state, between investors, between Wall Street, and between oil companies. And in some ways, it's a smokescreen. The profits that they see there are very, very tenuous. Just like in the United States with the fracking boom, where we know that after, you know, 10 plus years of enormous investment, or 20 years, fracking has never made a profit. People have gotten rich off of it, companies have gotten rich off of it, but it's a lot of hot air that's kept these projects going. And so to come back to Line 3 and to come back to indigenous resistance to these pipelines, I think part of what's so powerful for us in the climate movement to understand is that what happens when people on the land whose land this is oppose a project like this is it's bringing back to reality the stakes, and it's bringing back to reality the context of what's happening. We're polluting water, we're building these enormous infrastructure, and for what, right? For who does it benefit? That return to kind of like the choke points of this fight, I think it's just the most important thing that we can be a part of in the climate movement right now.
Well, you're listening to Lucas Focus here on KBU Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with Elijah Cetus, who's with the Braided River Campaign, and he recently visited the site where the Line 3 pipeline is proposed to go. You're talking about these Canadian companies that are definitely colonizing and have been colonizing Indigenous land for over a century and more. But it's an interesting parallel down here in the lower 48, where it's Canadian companies that are also terrorizing and trying to colonize Southern Oregon in the form of the Jordan Cove LNG terminal and the Pacific Connector pipeline. It's Pembina. Pembina also tried to do some damage here in Portland not so many years ago with proposing to build a liquid propane terminal that was going to be enormous right across from Hayden Island. So I wanted to talk about that dynamic, because it seems that as bad as we think American capitalism is, it seems to me that these Canadian oil companies are really on the cutting edge of awful.
Yeah, I would draw such a clean distinction maybe between Canadian capitalism and American capitalism. I think, you know, what I saw in living in Canada is the collusion, the land theft, the government buying a pipeline, for example. It's so much more visible, right? And especially to an outsider's eyes. As a settler person trying to think about how to be in relation to Indigenous resistance and Indigenous people in this movement, you know, we talk about unsettling our perspective, unsettling the settler narrative and the settler understanding of the land. And so I think for us, we can see it really well. When a Canadian company comes, for example, to Southern Oregon and says, we're going to build a pipeline, you know, the Jordan Cove LNG pipeline, we're going to use eminent domain to take land, and we're also going to pay your police departments to basically be our privatized security force. And the same thing is happening with Line 3, same thing happened with Dakota Access Pipeline. And what's especially unsettling about it is that there's a process of, I think, kind of normalization that happens, both from a kind of, from our understanding of the fights themselves, where, you know, we all were appalled at when we saw at Standing Rock, you know, the Tiger Swan Security Force just being incredibly violent to protesters, and especially to Indigenous and Black and people of color protesters and women. But I think, you know, we also are, we get used to that violence. You know, I'm reminded of a song I heard on the radio the other day, just after the Derek Chauvin murder trial, where the song lyrics were like, you know, we get so used to someone having a loaded gun and shooting, right? And the same thing happens on the land, right? Like, these pipelines are loaded guns, and then literally the state is using violence to protect a company, and the company is paying the state to do that. So in Line 3, in Minnesota, you know, the Enbridge has been paying the police forces across the state to respond. And so when we were there, for example, we saw police cruisers from counties in southern Minnesota, from counties across the state up north. And we saw too that they were coordinating. They have a location where they meet all these different officers and sort of how to stage their response. And this is all being paid for by the pipeline company. Likewise, we saw, you know, at the site of the pipeline itself near the Mississippi River crossing, we saw these signs that I will never forget, which is, you know, it is illegal to enter this area because it's the property of Enbridge Pipeline. And, you know, and what's so interesting is it's like, this isn't Enbridge's property, right? Like, they're crossing land. They have a lease to cross it. They have permits to cross it, but it's not their land. And actually, we heard a story that the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources had come back and had actually put their label over the sign where it had formerly said Enbridge. And so they're sort of stepping in as the sovereign entity to say, oh, no, actually, this is our territory. But you see really beneath the surface there, you see that, okay, this is the state, this is the pipeline company working in collusion, and it's the state protecting the pipeline company.
What I've seen, it's very interesting in Southern Oregon, is that the white settler people who are fighting the pipeline in conjunction with all the tribes, the Klamath, the Yurok, the Hoopa, and the Coos tribes that are all really in the forefront of fighting the Pacific Connecticut Gas Pipeline. But the white settlers are starting to understand what Indigenous people have been going through here for 150 years. And I've heard several of them who are probably dyed-in-the-wool Republicans who are talking about understanding what it means to have your land taken from you. And I wonder if you see that this appreciation on the part of white settlers in Southern Oregon is something that can really help build the climate movement.
I think so. I think, you know, dispossession is a fact of capitalism, right? It's how capitalism works, by taking people off the land, by taking people away from subsistence economies or from a kind of stability that can produce, social cohesion that can just lead to communities, right? Having protection for one another. Capitalism is constantly disrupting that because, you know, if you're able to feed yourself, if you're able to harvest wild rice like that grows in northern Minnesota and is such an important crop, then you can't be a wage slave, right? In the same way that we are. And so I think the United States, I think we have to be very careful about how we talk about this as white settlers. In no way is the experience of dispossession that white settlers have experienced the same or comparable to the genocide and land theft of indigenous peoples or African-American peoples for that matter. But it's a process, right, that we can understand as replicating and as impacting white settlers too. You know, my ancestors lived in Appalachia. I have no idea my connection to them, in part because they moved, right? In part because they were dispossessed and moved on. And, you know, I think a problem that happens is that we forget that process as white settlers in this country. We take for granted the fact of, you know, displacement. And I think that can be a real problem in terms of these pipeline fights where, you know, landowners can say, well, other folks are doing it, you know, it's inevitable, the company is going to come through. The best thing I can do is basically make a deal and get what I can from it. I understand that position. I think it's also terribly sad. And I think that one of the more powerful lessons that we white settlers can learn from indigenous resistance to these pipelines and to natural resource extraction is that through struggle against something, a company, a project coming in and degrading that landscape or harming the things that we depend on to survive, our water, our air, our food, we understand more about what it will take to move our economy away from this extractive capitalist economy, which is, I truly believe, is more communities having the right to say no. And from that position of saying no, being able to articulate and find the real solutions that they need to live in a place and to live in a place that, you know, not dependent on extractivism in the same way. You know, I think a lot about the time I heard Tara Hauska of the GNU Collective and of Honor the Earth, who's an Anishinaabe attorney, fighting Line 3. When I heard her speak, you know, she spent a lot of that talking actually about this idea of water is life, right? And this idea that we have to take that seriously. And I think we as settlers really do need to take that seriously and really consider what does it mean to live on this stolen land and what does it mean to live well on this stolen land and to live thoughtfully. And I think in large part it means paying attention and caring for and being in solidarity with the people who the original inhabitants of this land who have been in this movement. And for, you know, since 1492, the first and, you know, most effective and powerful organizers, basically, or resistors or activists, I don't know what the term we use, water protectors, right, to defend the wildlife, the plants and animals, the non-human, you know, beings that we all depend on. And I think, you know, capitalism has a crazy way of kind of breaking our brains so that we forget that, right? And I love that you brought up the Jordan Cove landowners because they organized, right? And in doing so, they got to know one another. They built deeper relationships to their neighbors, to their place, and now we you know there's conversations about offshore wind, and it's so inspiring to hear that organizing in the way that you know, from that act of saying no, much deeper relationships can kind of emerge.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LP FM and KOD XLP FM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with Elijah Cetus, who's with the Braided River Campaign, and he recently visited the site where Line 3 Pipeline is proposed to go through in northern Minnesota. One of the differences, it seems to me, between the perspective of white settlers who are dislocated from their land and indigenous people is the indigenous people I've heard say over and over again, we can't leave. We have no other place to go. This is our home and our home. And this goes back thousands and thousands of years. I wonder how you see that that influences their commitment to the fight and what it means when you feel like a place is your only home, as opposed to us white people like me. I came from New England, you know, by way of California. I've lived in a number of different places. I'm not sure how many places you've lived in, but it's very different. Even from my indigenous friends who have lived in other places, they have a certain connection to home that I'm not sure white people have quite understood yet.
Yeah, I think that's the work of white people right now, to be honest, or a huge part of our work is to really understand what it means to live on this stolen land. And I think first off, what it means is you have to learn, right? You have to learn who the original inhabitants are, what tribes, you know, are in this area. And I think that's primarily the purpose of the land acknowledgement is to ground whatever work you're doing, you know, whatever meeting you're about to have or whatever, with that fact. I also think you have to learn the relationships of, you know, the place that you're in and really be invested in that place. I think about, a lot of the time I think about plants in the sense that I think about, you know, how do we actually move away from oil and gas economies and you know, mining based economies? And really we have to, the work is, I think you have to get in deep relationship with plants and with animals too, because they are truly the renewable resource. You know, I'm so inspired by Honor the Earth, which is leading the Line 3 fight. You know, Winona the Duke talks a lot about hemp and not only about wild rice as the food, but hemp as a cash crop and as a crop that actually can be used to create a lot of goods and to create a lot of you know, materials we need. Like, we have to think about that. And I tell this to people all the time when I get a chance to talk to, you know, younger activists and stuff too, is I say, like, I think the most important thing that I've started to learn as I've started this work is, like, what are the plants in my area? How can I use them? How can I also be like a steward for plants? How can I get to know some of the ecological relationships? How did, you know, indigenous people manage this landscape? You know, I think those are the questions that I want to be having. And I think a lot of people want to be having right now as we move into the next era of this climate movement, which, you know, we're still fighting pipelines. But I think we're going to be moving into a time of really looking at, you know, what is renewable energy and clean energy in these kind of, like, you know, this new economy, how's that going to work? And so I think too, the other thing that's really important about place, and people is having a certain respect for the land, you know, and for the people of the land. So one of the things that was really powerful about going to Line 3 and staying in one of the camps for that week to support is that, you know, we were guests. We were really, really guests in a deep way, because we were staying with people whose land this was, and also people who had been and have been on the front lines for, you know, many years. And that relationship, you know, their experience is really important. And so we were there to learn, and we were there to be supporters and to come and show up in right relationship, you know, and try and do our best to show up in a positive way and listen. And it's a really hard work to do that. But I think it doesn't stop when you're visiting, you know, an indigenous-led prayer camp or pipeline resistance camp. Like, that's not just at Standing Rock and Sacred Stone Camp or just at Line 3. Like, that's everywhere. How do we show up in a way where we're really listening to the people you know, who have been here and who have been in the resistance movement for a long, long time, right? Like, if I want to learn about salmon and I want to learn about salmon conservation on the Willamette River, which I love, you know, or the Columbia River, you know, how do I go about doing that? Well, I think you look to the people who live here, have lived here for millennia, the indigenous Columbia River tribes, and then look at the ways that they've fought to protect that resource, to protect that species, you know, and learn that history. Yeah, I think that's ultimately the one of the most important things that I've taken away from the small participation I've gotten to have in some of these pipeline fights in Squamish and in Vancouver and Line 3 in Jordan Cove.
What inspired you to go to Line 3? And also, did you go to Standing Rock when that was going on as well?
I didn't. I was in Squamish. I helped organize a supply drive. And a friend of mine who is Métis, she actually went to go bring him. And it's a wild story because she was stopped at the border by U.S. Border Patrol and was not allowed access into the United States because her car was carrying supplies for Standing Rock. We organized a bunch of supplies and we didn't make it. What led to us going to Line 3? So I went with my partner who's from Minnesota, southern Minnesota, and my mom who did go to Standing Rock and who I credit her and my stepdad as really being my entry into this movement, and so I'm super grateful for that. And I went with a friend, Art, who's also on our steering committee at Portland Harbor Community Coalition, where I work. And I'd known that my mom and Art had gone to Standing Rock, and when we heard that there was a kind of call out for support on this week of action, and it was being organized by folks from Extinction Rebellion and nationally, and we knew organizers here in the Thin Green Line movement in Portland who were plugged into that and were going, you know, I talked to my partner and we said, this seems really important. Can we do it? And then I called my mom and I said, do you want to go? Can we do it? And then I called Art because I know that Art had been at Standing Rock, and he said yes. And he said to me, and this is why I bring it up, is he said, you know, it's so important when there's an ask, especially from indigenous, you know, peoples who are in the fight. When there's an ask, you go. So that was the guiding kind of spirit of us going. We went with open minds, and we're not really sure what we were expecting.
Now, there's been concern, I know, during Standing Rock, that there was concern both from the tribes and I think from non-tribal people, that some of the people who went out there were really kind of going out as maybe activism tourists as opposed to people who are really taking part in the struggle. And I wonder how one makes sure that you're not a tourist when you come to a camp like that.
Yeah, that was on my mind the whole time we were there. And I've thought a lot about it since, because I think we could have gone in a better way, to be honest. But we didn't know what we were expecting. I think the most important thing, and I think if you're listening to this and considering finding a way to maybe go support the camps or lend a hand through local action here, I think being self-sufficient is the most important thing. Being able to support your party, your affinity group, and then also being sure to ask, to always ask. There are ways to get in touch with folks at the camps, the Honor the Earth. You know, you can reach out to organizations there. Stop Line 3 is a great organization. Stop the Money Pipeline. And then the Indigenous-led camps there, McGeezy and Gnu Collective. I don't know if they need people coming right now, but I think that's the first thing is ask. And the second thing is be self-sufficient. The third thing is follow Indigenous leadership. So that means really listening and not showing up, you know, thinking you're going to throw down in this way or the other, getting frustrated because maybe you're not being told everything that's going to happen, or maybe you want to just go do something. Like that kind of like machismo bravado stuff is like really unhelpful. I think we're not always going to be as helpful as we want to be. I will say, a lot of our time there was spent fixing the roads after the spring melt had washed out some of the roads at the camp.
I hope we were helpful. We washed a lot of dishes. I hope we were helpful. But I think, yeah, I mean, I think activism, tourism is a real thing. I also think, you know, right now it's really important, and always with these movements, it's important to organize where you are and organize with your people and start from that root. There's great organizing happening in Portland. Indigenous Bloc is a group of organizers here in Portland. It's an indigenous-like group. They're organizing not only to stop Line 3, but also for water at Warm Springs. So please check them out. You want to be self-sufficient. You want to be prepared. You want to have a sense how you can help, what your limitations are. You want to come in with a spirit of generosity, listening. And then I also think, you know, money, supplies, these things are important. And then, yeah, and then starting locally too. So, for example, I think, you know, here in Portland, a big thing we could do, and this happened during Standing Rock, I've just been thinking about this, this happened during Standing Rock, is, you know, the city of Portland put out a resolution opposing the Code Access Pipeline and being in solidarity with Standing Rock. It's a small gesture, but it could happen anywhere, and that's something we can always do. And also, you know, I think the Stop the Money Pipeline has been so effective because divestment really does matter. And not only individually, but also, you know, big institutions. And there are a lot of institutions, a lot of pension funds that are invested in fossil fuel projects. And, you know, and that's always a target. And so organizing, you know, is explicitly in support of and solidarity of these projects, but targeting your local targets, working from the home place outward, that's, I think, a good place to start too.
Where is this project at now, Line 3, and how good a chance do you think that there is that it'll be stopped?
It will be stopped. We have to believe that, and I do believe that, and I think if we believe that, it'll happen.
What's happening materially? I mean, because it seems like it is, on the one hand, the physical presence at the camps, but also is there legislation that's being worked on? Is anybody trying to get Biden's ear to get him to have this be the next pipeline that he's going to stop?
So there are some really important moments kind of coming up. The Mississippi has not been crossed. You know, that's a difficult process, crossing a river body for them. It was the same with Dakota Access. So that's a choke point, and it hasn't happened yet. And there's still time for the Biden administration to basically overrule a very particular permit that I wish I had the name for it, for that, for the Mississippi River crossing. So that particular place, that can still be stopped. And I believe it will be stopped.
Now, people go to the websites for stopping Line 3, and I have the websites on the Locus Focus website. Why don't you give out those websites again? And so if people go there, can they get more information about actions that they can take?
Yeah, absolutely. So first go to stopline3.org, and that's a good summary and good introduction, and they're really a front door for people to get involved. Also go to Stop the Money Pipeline. That's the divestment group that it's a big, you know, coalition that's doing amazing work, not only on Line 3, but the Trans Mountain Pipeline as well. And then you go to Honor the Earth to learn more about the local and regional resistance there. And then if you want to donate, you should go to the protestlaw.org/line3. This organization has been funding, the Center for Protest Law and Litigation has been funding Rapid Response Bail Fund. And there has been over, you know, 200 arrests of activists, indigenous activists and allies in Minnesota. They need more money. So please, please support them that way directly if you can. Those are the big ones for sure.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And we're talking today with Elijah Cetus, who's with the Braided River Campaign, and he recently visited the site where the Line 3 pipeline is proposed to go. Well, you were talking a little earlier about the importance of working locally, so I thought in the last few minutes of the show, we'll talk about the local work you're doing with the Braided River Campaign. I know there's some events coming up, and this is a organization that probably most people in Portland don't know about yet. So what is the Braided River Campaign, and what are you planning on doing in the near future?
Yeah, thank you, Barbara. So the Braided River Campaign is a new coalition effort from of river advocates, folks working on the Superfund cleanup. I work with the organization Portland Harbor Community Coalition. We're a member. There's also the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group, Willamette River Advocacy Group, a number of local people from North Portland who've been advocating for a very long time for a just cleanup of the Superfund site here in Portland. But the coalition came together because the future of the Portland Harbor is very uncertain right now. And we need to have a grassroots vision for that, for a climate resilient, green working waterfront there. You know, the Portland Harbor is home to, it's our little fossil fuel hub in Portland. It's actually not little at all. It holds 90% of Oregon's oil and gas. And it actually also holds a connection to the tar sands, and that's the Zenith Energy oil terminal. That site opened in 2018, and that's how I got involved with this movement, and that led to the Braid River campaign. For me, was organizing to stop the tar sands oil trains that were coming to North Portland, passing through Vancouver, Washington, and all along the gorge, and then coming into the St. John's neighborhood and the neighborhood of Linton. Zenith Energy is a great example of why we need to have a just transition plan for that Portland Harbor. It is, you know, it's an ongoing environmental justice catastrophe. There's pollution, risk of spills, explosions in that area. And we know that it's going to be abandoned or left, you know, nothing is going to happen to that area where all this oil and gas is stored unless there's a community vision at the forefront for a just transition, for a new clean energy economy there, for better habitat, for community benefits through the Superfund cleanup. So the Braid River campaign is a kind of big tent effort to really have a Green New Deal in the Portland Harbor, and, you know, not only hold the thin green line against oil trains and the oil terminals there, but to really advance a positive vision and advance that climate justice frame.
I became aware of the Braid River campaign kind of right at the beginning of the pandemic, which seems like when it was really being formed. And I was curious how you form a new organization in the middle of a pandemic when you can't get together very easily to have in-person meetings.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a lot of Zoom. It's a lot of actually socially distanced one-on-one meetings. You know, many of us came into this work in part because our co-founder, Sarah Taylor, who's a Linton resident, was leading environmental justice tours on the river. And of that, you know, that oil and gas hub. And so I think maybe it's, you know, we had all had that powerful experience learning that history of displacement and really seeing the impacts of that site. But it led us to in the pandemic, as our brains were running wild about the future, it led us to just say, let's go for it. And I do think this is the time for visionary work. I think this is the time for a lot of reasons. I keep thinking about this quote by Arundhati Roy in an article she wrote for the Financial Times, where she said, you know, the pandemic is a portal. And I really believe that this is a portal. So we've been trying to organize through it, and we're going to have our first press conference rally down at the Port of Portland Terminal 2, where we're going to call for a green working waterfront. Invite you to join us and, yeah, help us create those demands. So thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about Terminal 2, because most people probably have no idea what it is. But I've spent a little bit of time out there, thanks to Bob Salinger. And what makes Terminal 2 special in terms of all the different pieces of property that the Port of Portland owns?
Well, Terminal 2 is not being used right now. And it sits right at this nexus of, you know, very close to downtown, very close to the Giles Lake industrial area where the fossil fuel tanks are stored, next to the Superfund. And its future is very, very uncertain. I think it's a kind of testing place for, you know, what we want our working waterfront to be in the future. Because, you know, for a long time, what was proposed there was a baseball stadium. And we've seen that at Terminal 1, which is just south of it, we saw that get turned into condos. So, you know, it's important to us because as far as our coalition is and our and residents, we don't want to see a baseball stadium that just goes to, you know, some corporate profits and tourism. We don't want to see condos that just gentrify that area. We want to see a community-centered waterfront that creates access and good jobs and clean energy you know, this new economy. So that's why we've gone there. That's why we're going to be there that day is you know, that site really represents that big question mark about the future of the Portland Harbor. And so, yeah, we're excited to be in that conversation at the site.
I was down at Terminal 2 with Bob Salinger a few months ago doing an interview, and we had a wonderful experience with the Peregrine Falcon. We're doing the interview, and suddenly Bob, who's very attuned to the sounds of Peregrine Falcons, said, "There sounds like a Peregrine Falcon." So we looked up on this crane, and there was a falcon sitting up there calling out to us. And I made some comment about it wanting to be on the radio, and as soon as I said that, it really put out a lot of calls. So it seemed to me that that was really indicative of what the potential for that area was, that the Peregrine Falcons already have a footing there. I'm sure the salmon are trying to do the same. So how do you see, actually more concretely, what would you like to see happen at Terminal 2?
You know, it's a really good question. We're trying to balance, why I say it's a question mark, the future. And I think even as we, Brady River Campaign is looking at this vision for Portland Harbor, we're trying to hold multiple things at once. We know that that area has, you know, historically not been, it's been really harmful on the natural world, on plants and animals. But they're still there, and it's a super ecologically rich area. At the same time, it is a really important industrial area for, you know, for a future of kind of green manufacturing, workforce training. There's a lot of longshore jobs. There's a lot of jobs that can be there. So I don't have, you know, one answer. I want to see habitat integrated. I want to see river access. We want to see, you know, jobs in the community. We want to see, you know, sustainable industry and manufacturing and kind of green port. We think they can be integrated. We think that business as usual has not brought any of those things together. And that actually it's been an area that's very privatized. That's very much what the corporations want. And so, yeah, I don't have a great answer, but I do love about Terminal 2, that you can see right across the way, this beautiful beach, on Swan Island that I always think about cause it's like so lovely. And I just imagine that the only people who go there are workers. And I would love to see workers and community be able to go there. And I would love to see, you know, good jobs in that area too. So we'll see.
One last thing I'd like to bring up. I'd like to come back to Zenith, which you just kind of mentioned very briefly. But I'm curious what's going on with the Zenith plans to expand their terminal so they can transport a lot more tar sands oil through Portland. Is that something that Brady River Campaign is working on? And is that something that you see there's hope of actually making Zenith comply with the vision of Portland's infrastructure, fossil fuel infrastructure ban?
Yeah. So Brady River Campaign members are working on that. The formerly named Stop Zenith Collaborative and now Cedar Action has been bottom lining that fight. And then allies of ours in the space, Breach Collective, Columbia Riverkeeper, Willamette Riverkeeper, Oregon PSR, they have been holding down that fight. And I've been part of that organizing efforts too. We're at a moment where the city of Portland basically has to make a decision about whether or not Zenith's activity moving crude oil fits our land use planning. So as Braided River Campaign is fighting for new vision for land use planning in the Portland Harbor, we already have a land use plan on the books, and we already have an oil terminal that was never supposed to be an oil terminal there. We had passed the fossil fuel terminal ban, and Zenith had basically, just like Enbridge in Line 3, said they were modernizing an asphalt facility, and then it had instead moved crude oil. So that expansion already happened, but what's at stake here is Their current permit, they're operating under an expired and more than 20-year-old air permit. They need to get a new one, and the city of Portland has the ability to weigh in and to really hold the line and say, you know, we don't want crude oil trains moving through our city. We don't want tar sands. We don't want to support the tar sands industry, which we know Zenith moves. We don't want to have fossil fuels that don't, you know, directly serve the local local people. And we certainly don't want that on our river. So we have a window right now where they can basically step up and enforce their own land use planning. And I, you know, we're fighting for that to happen. So
how's the best way that people can get involved in that one?
Good question. Columbia Riverkeeper is probably the most easily accessed group. But if you know folks in 350 PDX also, that's probably the best way, actually, 350 to start organizing. And then you can find your way into Cedar Action. I also urge everyone, you know, who's listening to just write an email to your city commissioners. You can CC them all and just say it's important to you that they hold the line and stop Zenith moving crude oil by rail. Now's the opportunity.
Well, Elijah, thanks very much for being on Locus Focus today. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you, Barbara. Likewise.
We've been talking with Elijah Cetus with the Braided River Campaign, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm and listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And now, during our spring pledge drive, you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage, or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Next week, we'll talk with Damon Mott-Story with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility about the emerging threat posed by small modular nuclear power reactors, which are being ardently promoted by supposed environmentalists like Bill Gates. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with some music by Alder Manning. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.
My heart's been heavy for some time. All seems so hopeless, so I try. And on the daily we're fed lies. From the top, the left and right. And as I sunk into despair, I wondered who still even cared. But I'm not one to back down, so I decided to stand my ground. When they push us down, we will rise back up. We will fight the fight, we're not giving up. When we come together, hope again. The gap between the rich and poor grows on the daily ever more. Too busy making both ends meet to raise our voices in the street. They push us down systemically. Gold is their god, they're full of greed. Billionaires of this country, when did you lose your humanity? When they push us down, we will rise back up. We will fight the fight, we're not giving up. When we come together, stand hand in hand, the power of the people renews my hope again. pulled the wool off of our eyes. And we will call them out on their lies. When they push us down, we will rise back up. We will fight the fight, we're not giving up. Again.